This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Southern California has seen its share of strange events, but it's safe to say that even there, nobody expected the Los Angeles Clippers to become one of the NBA's best teams. And yet the Clippers, with a record of 10-5, are indeed among the league's elite. Long known, if known at all, as Los Angeles's other team, the Clips have a well-documented, nay, celebrated history of futility. And what will Clippers fans do if their team actually keeps this up? For that answer and more, we turn to Bill Simmons. He's the man behind The Sports Guy, a popular column for ESPN.com. He's also a Clippers season ticket holder. Bill, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, it's good to be here. Yeah, it's always weird when somebody IDs me as a Clippers season ticket holder.
Yeah, I would think it would be weird and potentially embarrassing before this season.
Yeah, well, this is my second year, and last year I got the tickets because I just wanted to see the other teams, which is basically why anybody gets Clippers season tickets out here. I just thought it was my best chance to get to see LeBron and KG and Paul Pierce, all these guys. They showed some signs last year, and I basically did it for my column. I liked watching Sean Livingston so much that I was like, screw it, I'm getting him again. And then they made the Cassell trade, which was really one of the all-time highway robbery trades, and even got a number one pick in it, gave up this guy Marco Yark, who's terrible. And that basically turned the whole team around.
You mentioned Sam Cassell, who may be the best player the Clippers have right now, but he also has a reputation for being a difficult guy, especially when things aren't going well. Knowing the history of the team, how do you think Cassell will behave when they lose a few games?
Well, I think the key with him, and the reason I was excited about the trade, was because it's a contract year for him. So it's in his vested interest to behave. And he's one of those guys that in person, I just never realized how much fun he was. And he's really kind of joyful. Just watching him during the games, like just the energy that he brings to the table and the way he interacts, even with like the refs and the opposing guys, he's very professional. It's kind of changed the attitude of the team, him and Ketino Mobley. I would compare them to one of those really good March Madness teams where they have the two veteran guards. They got the one inside guy. They make their free throws at the end of the game. They make threes. Like, they're just kind of a smart, organized team.
Something of which the Clippers have rarely been accused in the past.
It's surreal because the Lakers, you know, Kobe is like Tony Montana at the end of Scarface right now, just completely going into the tank, and that whole team's a disaster. So it's really funny to kind of watch the celebrities start showing up at these Clippers games and people around here starting to talk about it. And I've only been here 3 years, but this really is probably the biggest bandwagon sports city I've ever interacted with. You know, just in the 3 years I've been here, Matt Leinart replaced Kobe as the sports celebrity god. And it would be funny if that happened with one of the Clippers.
Well, of course, people who watch NBA games are familiar with many of the celebrities who have a history of showing up at Lakers games, and Jack Nicholson heads the A-list, I suppose. Who's been showing up at Clippers games?
The most famous Clippers celebrity season ticket holder is Billy Crystal, but he only goes to like 3 or 4 games a year because he's traveling so much. The person that goes the most is Penny Marshall. She's at every game. And the weird thing is she brings Laura Flynn Boyle. So they're kind of making an odd couple because Penny's probably pushing 2 bills now. Laura Flynn Boyle is about 80 pounds. And it's just kind of funny to see them sitting together eating popcorn. And Penny eats most of it, and Laura maybe has like 2 kernels.
You know, I don't think we've ever done gossip in the A segment before.
Well, it was funny. Like, I went to a game 2 weeks ago, and Jason Bateman sat 2 rows in front of us, who's one of the guys from Arrested Development, and just could not have been less interested in the game and had that look on his face like, hey, they told us it would be cool to come here. It is going to be funny to watch these celebrities start trickling in, especially because tickets are really easy to get still.
What about the real fans, though? Are they giddy with this new development, or are they suspicious that they're going to wake up one morning and it's all going to be a dream?
No, there's a confidence. You can feel it. And the weird thing about Clippers fans is there are a lot of them. You forget, like, L.A. is humongous. It's just this huge, sprawling city where a lot of people are making money. It's so hard to get Lakers tickets that a lot of these people just ended up buying Clippers tickets, hoping and praying that they'd be good someday because it's a real chip to have, you know, especially out here when you're trying to court clients and stuff like that. So you have all these people that have been coming for 20 years. I sit next to this guy who's owned tickets since they moved from San Diego. His son is 20 and goes to Stanford. His son has never seen them win a playoff series. And they've had those tickets for 2 decades. So they don't know what to make of this whole thing. Like, it's kind of cute in a way, you know?
Is it even more kind of fun because, as you mentioned, at the same time that the Clippers are doing so well, the Lakers are imploding?
No question. No question. The Lakers-Clippers relationship is so dysfunctional, and the last 20 years, they're really the laughing stock. They're like a punchline out here where the Lakers have always been successful and have always been the marquee team. The Clippers were the team. They played in a crummy arena. They played in the L.A. Sports Arena. No celebrities went to the games. They always stunk. So it's pretty cool how it's working out.
Finally, Bill, I don't want to jinx things for you and the rest of the season ticket holders and all those new celebrities who've climbed on board the bandwagon, but can the Clippers actually win the division?
Absolutely. There's two big factors. First, they're probably, you know, other than the Spurs, probably the deepest team in the whole conference. When Livingston comes back, they're going to be going 10 deep, and they always have three scorers on the floor no matter what time of the game it is. The other factor is the West has just gotten worse. Like, you look around, like, you know, the Lakers are worse. Amari Stoudemire goes out for the year, so Phoenix is a little sketchy. You get T-Mac got hurt in Houston, so they're pretty much out of it. Denver's already had a ton of injuries. Nobody else has really stepped up other than maybe Golden State, and everyone knows Baron Davis is going to get hurt. So the Clippers just seem like they're in just prime position to make something happen this year.
Bill Simmons is a columnist for ESPN.com and a Clippers season ticket holder, something he can claim proudly now. Bill, thank you very much for joining me.
All right, it's my pleasure.
In the 1920s and 30s, the heart of downtown Brooklyn was, like nearby Manhattan, a thriving metropolis. Located there were popular restaurants, theaters, and movie houses. A remnant of those days still stands on Flatbush Avenue, but it now serves a different purpose. The Brooklyn Paramount Theater became the Schwartz Athletic Center in 1963, part of Long Island University's Brooklyn campus. Now, but not for much longer, college athletes play basketball and volleyball in the same Art Deco space where their grandparents watched Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, and various stars of stage and screen. Tara Anderson of member station WFUV reports.
It's a Tuesday night at the Schwartz Athletic Center, and the crowd stands for the national anthem before the basketball game. The organ we're hearing tonight is a recording, but in the past, fans have been treated to the mighty Wurlitzer, rising majestically out of the floor, late New York Yankees organist Eddie Layton at the console. Why is there a theater organ in a gymnasium? Because once upon a time, these walls echoed with the sounds of King Kong, Mae West, and Little Richard, when it was known as the Brooklyn Paramount. Athletic director John Suarez.
There was no sound back then. So, you know, they used to play the organ as the movie went on, if you've seen some of the old movies. All the stars would actually come down this big balcony, which is actually serves as our cafeteria right now, which is kind of neat.
The Brooklyn Paramount opened in 1928, a 4,000-seat movie palace with plush upholstered seats and gold leaf covering the walls and ceiling. The curtain was midnight blue velvet embroidered with satin pheasants. The fountains were full of goldfish, and that Wurlitzer organ was equipped with a lighting system that changed color according to the mood of the music. Chorus girls paraded down the golden staircases onto the stage, and stars like Bing Crosby, Ginger Rogers, and Milton Berle entertained the crowd. Today, a giant scoreboard hangs from the gilt ceiling. Those cushy seats have been replaced by bleachers, and it's the home court of the Long Island University Blackbirds. The music's a little different, too. In the 1950s and 60s, the Brooklyn Paramount became home to Alan Freed's legendary rock and roll shows, which featured acts like Buddy Holly, Jerry Lee Lewis, Fats Domino, and the Everly Brothers. Ken Tavani is the strength coach for the men's basketball team. He grew up in the neighborhood and saw Little Richard at the Paramount about 50 years ago.
I remember one night the place was packed, right? We were all in there, and he comes out on stage, and everybody's quiet, and he gets out, and he goes, and he stands up at the microphone, and he goes, and he must have held it for like 2 minutes. And then finally he goes, Jenny, 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 and you couldn't hear a word after that. The place went crazy. It was really a lot of fun. We had a lot of good times here.
But the rock and roll shows faded away, and the building was bought by Long Island University in 1963. The court now sits where the first 20 or so rows of seats used to be, and the proscenium arch that framed the screen is now a backdrop to the team's benches and officials' tables. It's a strange kind of dichotomy. From the floor to about 20 feet up, it's your standard gym, with the polished and painted wood floor and banners advertising soft drinks and local restaurants. But look up further, and the burnished gold decor takes over. Grecian maidens and frolicking cherubs line the walls, and it all culminates in an ornate latticework ceiling. The LIU Pep Squad sits in the bleachers during every home game, stomping and clapping to cheer on the team. Tishana Archer is the captain of the Pep Squad.
When I look up, I see all these statues, and I love it. It was the Paramount Theater. I feel like I was a part of history.
One of her teammates, who gave her name as Jamie, doesn't have such a romantic view.
It's nice. If it wasn't a gym, it's kind of awkward with the scoreboard, and then you look up and see all of that. Looking around here, it's not supposed to be a gym.
Long Island University officials agree and are waiting for the final inspection on a brand new $30 million athletic center, which will include a swimming pool, a fitness center, and a basketball arena. They say no matter how charming and historic the Short Center is, it doesn't really serve the needs of a big athletic program. The entire operation is moving to the new facility in early 2006. The Wurlitzer will stay here because the pipes are built into the walls and it can't be moved. Nobody can really say for sure what will happen to the building once the new athletic center is open. There's talk of keeping it as an extra practice facility, making it over into a student center, or even using part of it as a theater again. Men's basketball coach Jim Ferry acknowledges that it's time to move on, but that he will miss the Schwartz Center.
You get used to it at your home, and it's magnificent. The views are spectacular, and just the history that's behind it. And it will be sad when we shut the doors to it for a basketball program. It's time to move on a little bit. It's trying to modernize around here.
Both the men's and women's basketball teams are hoping to start playing in the new facility in mid-January, and the athletic department and other teams should make the move soon after. For Only a Game, I'm Tara Anderson in Brooklyn.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. If you can't bring New York to the Doyo, bring the Doyo to New York. But first, 35 years ago, a handful of professional card players gathered at a Las Vegas casino called Binion's Horseshoe for an event Mr. Binion himself optimistically called the World Series of Poker. The location, notwithstanding, the tournament might more accurately have been called the Championship of Texas, but since that day, the popularity of poker in general and a game called Texas Hold'em in particular have grown enormously, and the World Series has drawn players from all over the world. In All In, subtitled The Almost Entirely True Story of the World Series of Poker, Jonathan Grotenstein and Storms Reback chronicle the history of the tournament and profile some of poker's most memorable characters. Jonathan Grotenstein joins me from NPR West in Los Angeles. Jonathan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
Jonathan, the winner of the World Series of Poker can claim to be the best poker player in the world, but you point out early in the book that 35 years ago, that label might not have been welcome and beneficial. Why not?
Well, poker wasn't always the TV fueled exciting game that it is today. It was something that was traditionally played in shady back rooms or in elks lodges when the police were looking in the other direction. And there was a huge moral component to it in the sense that it was considered gambling by a lot of people who were respected within the community. Doyle Brunson, for one, who everybody looks at today as one of the greats of the game, was the son of a minister and knew that his father wouldn't approve of his being a professional poker player. There was also concern that the IRS, who had gone after gamblers in the past fairly recently, would look to the champion of poker as a target, someone who could be taxed a great deal. Without the accompaniment of celebrity that now comes with the title, there really wasn't any upside to being the world champion of poker.
Yeah, beyond all that, I would suppose that if you were known as the world champion of poker, some people might be reluctant to sit down at the table with you.
Well, that was another part of it. These guys did what was called fading the white line, traveling from town to town. And if, you know, word got out that these guys were sharps, obviously people would play them a lot differently, and the type of action that they could muster up would be a lot less.
I was surprised by how many of the winning players you mention in All In were alcoholics or drug addicts. I say were because some of them are dead. I thought winning in poker was all about patience and control. How did guys like Stewie Unger have such success?
It's funny, actually. Before we started this interview, someone asked me what the best buffet in Las Vegas was. And my knee-jerk answer was there are no good buffets in Las Vegas. But what I realized is that I've never been to a buffet in Las Vegas. Poker is kind of one of those all-encompassing games that you sit at a table, and you may wind up sitting at that table for two or three straight days before you go crawl into some room and collapse for a short period of time and come back to the table again. People who are attracted to poker tend to be people who are attracted to life's extremes. And that includes alcoholism and drug addiction. When you have people living at the fringes, they're going to dabble in these kinds of things. Stu Unger was a very special case. While he was playing poker, he seemed to be able to sort of wipe all of his demons out of his mind. He was totally focused on the game. The drugs, if anything, maybe helped him in the sense that they kept him alert during, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 day sessions. But there's no doubt that as far as the rest of Stewie's life was concerned, you know, the drugs tore him apart and brought the guy down at a much earlier age than he should have.
Many of the guys who've won the World Series of Poker have been knocked out of the tournament a year or two later, sometimes by amateurs and sometimes by guys who've previously only played on their computers in their game rooms or basements, never played against actual human beings. In poker played at this level, how big a factor is luck?
Luck is a tremendous part of poker. Even if you're the greatest poker player in the world and you only put your money into the middle in situations where you were a 70 or 80% favorite to win, odds are after 5 or 6 of those confrontations, you're going to lose one. A lot of great poker players will basically play their tournaments trying to avoid these confrontations. But for an amateur player, the one sort of edge that they've got over a professional, especially in a game like No Limit Texas Hold'em, is that they're able to risk all of their chips, thus forcing their opponent to risk all of their chips at any time. So even if an amateur gets his money into a situation where he's got the worst of it against a professional, he's going to win that confrontation 20, 30, 40% of the time. Combine that with the fact, especially in today's poker world where poker players have become celebrities, that what an amateur is looking for in a confrontation with a professional is a story. So they can push all in against the pro, and if they win or draw out on them or just happen to have the best of the situation, great. They can go home and tell all their friends that, yeah, I beat the great Phil Hellmuth. If they lose the situation, it's just as good a story. They go back and they're like, yeah, I got all my money in against Phil Hellmuth and I lost. So there's no up or downside. The whole upside is found in getting all their money into the middle during one of these confrontations, and you need luck to win them. So regardless of how good a player you are, luck is always going to play a factor.
The winner of the 2004 World Series of Poker said after the tournament that there were probably 1,500 players in this event better than me. Was he right?
I think time has shown that the player you're referring to, Greg Fosselman Raymer, might have been exaggerating a little bit. But the best player, especially given the huge size of today's field, is not necessarily going to win the tournament. More often than not, especially moving forward, the person who wins the World Series of Poker is going to be the person who enjoyed an almost supernatural degree of luck for a week-long period of time. Well, you've got to play not only the sharpest poker of your life, but survive all of these crazy confrontations for 6, 7, 8 days. This is where luck comes into play. Just being a great poker player is no longer enough to guarantee you're going to win.
You have a stake in the continuing popularity of Texas Hold'em on TV and elsewhere, but realistically, how long do you think it will be until some other way to lose and win money catches the attention of that game's current fans?
The larger question is whether or not, you know, the whole poker craze will continue, right? I mean, the way the question has been framed is poker more like golf or is poker more like cigars? Is it something that is just going to sort of enmesh itself in the American fabric and be, you know, every Saturday afternoon, of course, there's going to be a poker match on TV. I think poker is going to have a future. Harrah's, who owns the World Series of Poker property, has hired an executive producer from NASCAR. They've hired a director of marketing from the NFL. And they really intend for the lineup of sponsors at the 2006 World Series of Poker to look a lot like the Super Bowl. So the people who are in charge of the game right now understand how much is at stake and are taking all of the steps they can to make sure that poker and specifically the Texas Hold'em that's played at the World Series of Poker remains an integral part of the fabric of everyday existence.
Jonathan Grotenstein is the co-author of All In, the almost entirely true story of the World Series of Poker. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Jonathan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Luck be a lady.
Two major sumo wrestling competitions have been held in the U.S. this year. The most recent took place at New York's Madison Square Garden in October. Two dozen wrestlers from around the world came to the garden for the World Sumo Challenge. Three of them train at a martial arts center in New Jersey. It turns out that in addition to California and Hawaii, the Garden State is one of the places where sumo has taken hold in the United States. John Kalish has our report.
Welcome to the Cranford Judo and Karate Center in North Jersey. In the school's matted basement workout space, aspiring and perspiring sumo wrestlers practice on a chilly weeknight. The sensei here is Yanni Yaneshka, a former U.S. Olympic judo coach. He's also an advisor to a New York company that's promoting sumo in North America.
In the United States, a lot of people love to see the sumo, but we don't have enough people to participate in sumo. That's the problem. See, a lot of people think big, fat people. That is not true. We have a lightweight, middleweight, and a heavyweight. So any good athlete can do well.
Of course, the middleweight designation is still a bit intimidating in sumo. You can weigh up to 252 pounds and still compete as a middleweight. No matter what weight division you're in, though, the object is to force your opponent out of the dojo, an 18-foot ring used for sumo matches. Leonard Thomas is president of the U.S. Sumo Federation and a sumo coach at the Cranford Martial Arts Center.
The most important thing is pushing power. Usually pushing power doesn't come with the hands and the chest, it comes from the legs. When you squat, you come up and push, you're almost lifting your opponent and pushing them at the same time. So if you got real strong big legs, usually in Japan, that's who they used to look for. The little kids with the big butts and the big thighs, those are the ones that made the good sumo wrestlers.
Many of the regulars at this New Jersey sumo session came to the sport after learning judo. 44-year-old Dave Collins is a social worker who's been involved with sumo for about a year.
It was fast, it was powerful, it was strong, it installed discipline, confidence, so I started to do it. I've yet to fight in an actual tournament, but I hope to have at least one sumo match one day.
Sumo wrestlers are referred to as rikishi in Japanese. It literally means gentlemen of strength. But not all the rikishi at this Cranford dojo are gentlemen. 17-year-old Alicia McFarland is a high school senior and a nationally ranked judo competitor. She wore sweatpants, not a mawashi, the thong-like belt the men wear. McFarland likes colliding with her opponent at the beginning of the match. She explains her sumo strategy.
Don't let the person hit you. Don't accept the hit because you'll just get ran out the ring. Always hit first. That gives you the upper hand. And go inside and keep your elbows in. I really enjoy that, like, so much.
That hit.
Yeah. I try and come here every now and then and get a couple of hits in it.
Over the summer, McFarland went to Germany for a sumo tournament, but lost to a woman who was nearly twice her weight in a match that lasted less than 10 seconds. Some of the matches at the World Sumo Challenge on October 22nd didn't last much longer. Many in the crowd of 8,000 in Madison Square Garden chugged $7 beers and chanted sumo. The omnipresent pop music that punctuates Nick's games here gave way to traditional Japanese flutes and drums. Only three of the 24 wrestlers who competed were from Japan. Most of the rikishi were from Eastern Europe. One crowd favorite was a blonde, 342-pound Norwegian named Hans Borg, who held his arms aloft and motioned with his fingers to summon cheers. A practically diminutive Bulgarian received a great roar of approval when he beat a competitor who far outweighed him. Another Bulgarian by the name of Stoyanov made it all the way to the final match, but he wasn't exactly the crowd favorite.
From the West, Peter Stoyanov of Bulgaria! from the east, Mitsuhiko Fukao of Japan!
At one point, several referees gathered in the dojo ring to caucus on whether Fukao had won the match. Apparently, they couldn't reach a consensus, so the bout was held again. And the 340-pound Stoyanov was forced out of the ring a fraction of a second before Fukao, who weighed 411 pounds, hit the mat. Fukao was described by one sumo observer as a second-string sumo wrestler in Japan. Still, he went home with $10,000.
Mitsuhiko Fukao of Japan!
Sitting in the stands with his wife and son was Louis Foca, who is not a newcomer to the sport. Foca was somewhat disappointed with the level of competition in the garden, but he still thinks the evening served as a good introduction to sumo for American fans.
I've been to Japan twice. I like traditional sumo. The guys in traditional sumo are a little bit more competitive and stuff, and you see a lot more of the techniques. Most of these guys are bull rushing and using their palms and this and that. You don't see a lot of the technical throws, you might say. But it makes for a great show. Beats wrestling.
The International Sumo Federation, which governs the sport outside of Japan, has signed a deal with ESPN2. Sumo promoters are planning a tour of major North American cities in the spring and are readying a licensing campaign which will include action figures, video games, and clothing. And a lobbying effort is underway to introduce sumo as a demonstration sport at the 2012 Olympics. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
You're listening to Only a Game. During my conversation about the Poinsettia Bowl with Charlie Pierce on last week's program, Charlie casually mentioned that poinsettias are poisonous. Almost immediately, emails began pouring in from Cleveland, Columbus, and some cities that aren't even in Ohio. Wrong, they opined, and so I decided I'd better call Paul Ecke III, owner and proprietor of the Paul Ecke Ranch, poinsettia capital of Encinitas, California. Mr. Ecke was unequivocal in siding with the listeners.
Poinsettias are not poisonous. I've eaten them myself, and although they don't taste good at all, they are not poisonous. Now, I don't recommend anybody eating any of their holiday decorations, Christmas trees, candles, pine cones, wrapping paper, ribbon. Don't eat any of that stuff, but they are not poisonous, and we've got lots of evidence to support that. We commissioned a study back in the 70s with the Ohio State University where they fed rats poinsettia plants. No rats died, and in fact, all that happened was more rats appeared.
So poinsettias are an aphrodisiac.
Perhaps, although that I'm not going to endorse. But we also have rabbits in our greenhouse, and they are eating poinsettias, and once again, all we get is more rabbits. You know, we just have had no problems here in the Ecke family, and we've been around poinsettias for almost 100 years. And you would think that if anybody had any problems, it would be the Ecke family, since we've been doing poinsettias for so long.
What possessed you to eat one?
Oh, just because that somebody challenged me to do that when they said, you know, oh, if it really is poisonous, will you eat one? I said, sure, I'll eat one. Of course, if I do eat them, I insist on having a ranch dressing, of course.
Let me ask you another question since we've got you. How do you feel about there being a poinsettia bowl? Do they kind of mix well with the whole football idea?
We're very, very proud of that. We're excited because it's the only college football game named after a flower except one other minor bowl game called the Rose Bowl.
Paul Ecke presides over the poinsettias or poinsettias at Paul Ecke Ranch. Mr. Ecke, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
You can redress slander against your favorite flower by emailing us at onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us even more easily through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Our address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot Cheese.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Wild Scallions couldn't drag me away, but first I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Sunday, Temple's basketball team beat Miami convincingly in Philadelphia. One of the fans threw something onto the court, which brought out the lecturer in Temple coach John Chaney. Do we applaud his performance?
This happens once or twice a year now, where coaches in college basketball decide there's not enough attention paid to them and grab the microphone and play peacemaker to their fans. Perhaps if a few of the coaches, not naming any names, John Chaney, would modify their sideline behavior and not act like idiots so they get on SportsCenter, maybe less of this would go on.
Also in Philadelphia last weekend, a fan was arrested for running onto the field during the Eagles-Packers game, but at least he had a better excuse than most fans who run onto the field during the game, right?
Mom! Mom! I made it to the 50, Mom! And I knew it was your last wish to be trodden into the turf by Jeremiah Trotter. Guy sprinkled Mom's ashes at the field and then quite peaceably submitted to arrest.
Well, he'd done what he came to do.
Where he was charged, by the way, with one of the great crimes of all time, defiant trespass.
Whoa.
Not merely trespass, but defiant trespass.
The NCAA announced this week that it wants officials at college football games to crack down on, quote, post-touchdown antics. Is the idea here that the college game should come to resemble the NFL even more than it already does?
No, the idea here is the NCAA has an 8-foot pole stuck up a part of its anatomy and has had for 60 years and has never had it removed. It's become permanently grafted to the organization's spine. By the way, we're going to make a lot of money off these kids, but God forbid they be seen to be having any fun. Merry Christmas, you overfed buffet grazers.
The Lions, who didn't win on Thanksgiving and also haven't won on six other occasions this season, fired their coach, Steve Mariucci, earlier this week. Were you surprised that at least a couple of the Detroit players thought that that was the wrong move?
Well, we had a bit of a kerfuffle all week about Dre Bly, a cornerback, who pretty much said that if Jeff Garcia instead of Joey Harrington had been playing quarterback for the Lions, Mariucci would still have his job. There's a lot of huffing and blowing about, oh, it's the code, you don't throw your teammates out the window, oh, the code of the West. You know what you didn't hear? You didn't hear any member of the Lions saying that Dre Bly was incorrect in the substance of what he said.
Each year, the winner of the Army-Navy game gets the Commander-in-Chief's Trophy.
And that's a good thing.
Assuming there is a Commander-in-Chief's Trophy to award, which, as I understand it, seems to be in doubt this time around.
Now, we seem to have an honor code violation
Oops.
Here. The trophy was pilfered from a dormitory at the Naval Academy, and a note was left saying that by the time you read this, the trophy will be halfway to West Point. Now, I don't know if the cadets have to hire out, if they have to hire guys from, like, Utica College to steal the stuff for them. Perhaps they just got some independent contractors to do it. Who knows?
Regarding comments you made last week,
God.
We just heard from Paul Ecke III, the head honcho at the Paul Ecke Ranch, who insists that poinsettias are not poisonous. Time for remedial botany lessons?
I apologize to the Ecke Ranch, and I hope that they won't think it amiss for me if I invite myself to the annual poinsettia roundup. Yeah, get them, boys! Woo! Get that one!
All right, Mr. NASCAR, I want to present pages 24 and 25 of the November 25th Sporting News. Now, you've got it in front of you. Is it safe to assume, and I'll leave this description to you, is it safe to assume at least one person in layout at the Sporting News was fired for juxtaposing the article about Kurt Busch's driving misadventures with the ad featuring his car and a bottle of Crown Royal?
The only course I got lower than a B in at the Marquette University College of Journalism was layout and design. Why did I get a C? Because I used to do stuff like this. On the left, we have the weekly NASCAR column by Lee Spencer, a terrific NASCAR correspondent, with the headline, Could Busch, meaning Kurt Busch, not the brewery, by the way, could Busch have been dumber? Wait, don't answer that. And there he is in his nice purple fire suit and looking, quite honestly, rather dumb in the photo. And then we don't even have to turn the page.
No.
We go over here, and there it is. First of all, what the hell is Crown Royal doing sponsoring an automobile? There's a little disconnect between booze and automobiles, in case the Crown Royal folks and the NASCAR folks haven't noticed. Second of all, it's Kurt Busch's car. Every king deserves a crown. Could Busch have been dumber? Yes, he could have been a layout editor for the Sporting News.
When the World Baseball Classic rolls around in March, Barry Bonds will apparently be among the players representing the U.S. Is this a good thing?
No, because it's going to prompt somewhere between 350 and 9,000 columns about what a disgrace it is that a guy who we all know has used steroids is representing, Bill, our country overseas, our country. So, yes, I think, I mean, you know, it'll probably be decent for the team. It'll be interesting to see what Barry looks like. But at the same time, we're going to get a tsunami of sanctimony, and that's never a good thing.
And finally, Charlie, the first snowmobiler from Maine to make the Snowmobile Hall of Fame achieved that distinction this week. Assuming that you didn't know there was a Snowmobile Hall of Fame, are you encouraged to learn that there is?
Not only is there a Snowmobile Hall of Fame located in St. Germain, Wisconsin, also the home state of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in Hayward, Wisconsin, by the way. Not only is there a Snowmobile Hall of Fame, which E.B. Campbell, the late E.B. Campbell of Millinocket, Maine, joined this week. This was its 19th annual induction ceremony. So you know what? It's been around for longer than you think it has.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
And I'd like to give the memory of E.B. a big
bing ba da bing ba. Follow the white way to UN.
Boom ba da ba ding ba.
Cross the white frozen sand.
Scooby dooby doo.
Life is a sleigh ride to heaven.
Ooh,
snow is king in Uberland.
It's September 24th, an overcast and breezy morning on the shore of Lake Michigan. In a muddy park across a paved path from Chicago's Montrose Beach, groups of excited endurance athletes and wannabe endurance athletes huddle over maps, inspect their equipment, and try to figure out an event called the Wild Scallion Urban Adventure Race.
Okay, what does it say about Caldwell now?
Proceed north to Caldwell.
Out of the woods?
Out of the woods.
How is that north?
Paul, Rachel, and Dennis comprise one of the 85 three-person teams that will be running, bike riding, rollerblading, scootering, climbing, orienteering, and otherwise covering a route through Chicago and its environs over the next 6 to 10 hours. They are willing to acknowledge that they're pretty much lost before they begin, but these members of a team, the name of which I won't mention for fear of arousing the FCC, maintain that they do have a few strengths.
We'll be biking.
You look like the physical ones. You all look like you're in terrific shape, and you're, you know, is this a competitive thing?
Yeah, we'll be biking our tails off, and we'll probably do everything twice.
We usually go twice as far
because we get lost.
Minutes before the Wild Scallion Adventure Race is scheduled to begin, Paul, Rachel, and Dennis give up on trying to figure out which way is north and join the rest of the competitors on the windy beach, where one of the race organizers offers some advice.
Safety first, okay? The drunken Cub fans, none of them are going to care about you guys, all right? It doesn't matter you have a race number on. Please remember that. You're a pedestrian out there, okay? Yes, it's a race. Yes, it's a competition. But please be safe.
Drunken Cubs fans and motorists confused by the string of scooter riders and rollerbladers aren't the only dangers these competitors will face. There's the aforementioned getting lost, as the Wild Scallion Race requires not only the use of a compass to discover various stations in the woods, but orienteering through a cemetery as well. Competitors will also ford a river at least once, and at one checkpoint they'll push through chest-high water in Lake Michigan. And before all that, there's exhaustion. At one of the earliest checkpoints in the race, everybody will climb 99 flights of stairs in the Sears Tower. Beyond that, there is the matter of confronting the unknown, or at least the untried. Half an hour before the race, a guy who's never before been on rollerblades lurches by me. His knees are already bleeding. At the other end of the competitive spectrum are the teams made up of experienced adventure racers, people whose expenses are paid by shoe companies or equipment manufacturers. In between, according to race organizer John O'Connor, is the rest of the field. He explains the range of people to whom the Wild Scallion Race appeals as we stand beside the eternally running showers at the ancient Montrose Beach bathhouse.
We have a demographic range from 55 years old down to a 13-year-old competitor today, our youngest one ever. demographics typically are probably average age of about 35 to 38, mostly college educated or professionals, every walk of life from lawyers to doctors to city workers to everybody else.
The teams are split up into three divisions, the all-male, the co-ed, and the all-female, the third of which gets to start first.
All right, girls, show them how it's done, my friends. Go kick some ass. On your mark, get set, scallion!
After leaving Montrose Beach, the competitors run and rollerblade along the lake, eventually reaching the first checkpoint, where they must acquire the proof that they've arrived.
Take your skates off in the grassy area here. Team captain, get a card. Take your skates off on the grassy area.
Regrettably, I am not in good enough shape to accompany the teams along the entire course. I next catch up with one of the leading teams, Newcastle Limited of Crested Butte, as they're coming out of the Sears Tower, having climbed up and then down 99 floors without even hesitating to check out the view.
Once you got going down, it felt good. But that was, yeah, that was a good uphill. We don't have many stairs in Gunnison, Colorado.
Well, it sounds like you're a veteran of these things.
It's my first one.
It's my first one, too, and the next surprise I get is that one leg of the Wild Scallion race requires the competitors to ride the Chicago Transit System. I find my way to the appointed subway stop at the same time as an all-male team calling themselves Smelt boards the train. When we found our seats, Cal LeJune, one of the team members, explains the name.
I came up with the team name. I was under pressure. Little Fish. That's all I can say.
Cal LeJune is an architect. One of his teammates, Steve Goodman, is a chiropractor who sometimes finds himself thinking of his competitors as potential clients.
So as I run down the street, I say, "Man, that guy's got terrible posture." That's what I do.
This is Wilson.
It occurs to me, as we rumble north toward the Wild Scallion's next challenge, that a brief train ride might be a welcome opportunity to rest for people who've been tromping through high grass, climbing up and down a skyscraper, and attempting to scooter between Cubs fans. But Mark Bishop, the third member of Team Smelt, says it's a mixed blessing at best.
It doesn't make it easier, but it spreads out the geography. So it makes the terrain more interesting, but it doesn't make it easier. Because when you start back up, your legs will just turn to jello.
I hope not.
Yeah, I guess we all hope not, so.
As it turns out, Team Smelt leaves the train on steady legs and trots off toward the lake. I grab a ride with one of the race organizers, and we drive to another checkpoint on the edge of a wooded area through which the teams will have to bike and run. When we get there, I eavesdrop on two of the race organizers as they discuss a potential complication.
You know what? If it's raining, it's raining. If it's lightning, then we got another conversation to have.
This is nothing.
Oh, I know.
It's an adventure race.
It's a little drizzle.
Yeah.
The organizers have other concerns as well. A couple of hours into the race, they'd begun to hear rumors that some of the more organized and well-prepared teams might have been getting assistance on the course. Athletes who weren't competing were said to be helping with maps, directions, and suggestions about such matters as the easiest place to ford a river. An advisory seemed to be in order as the leading team came out of the woods.
Nobody helping you tee or anything, right? I'm telling all the leading teams that I don't want any, you know, rules things to mess,
yeah.
You know, mess
anybody.
Yeah,
we don't want that either.
Be real clear.
You learn that,
okay?
Just moments later, who should emerge, wet but game, from the woods, but Team Smelt?
Now you took the easy way, no fair.
Hey, how you doing?
A big friend.
Good going, guys.
Took a little time to get our legs back warmed up and then jumping in the lake, so. But we're feeling good, and still having a great time, even with the rain coming down.
Where's the next stop?
Where are we going?
We're up here. So
and where's the next stop? Oh, we have to take that trail. Do you have the yellow sheet that can tell us where we're going?
Hey, have fun.
All right. Good job, you guys.
An hour or so later, as soon as the traffic light across from the Oktoberfest celebration turned green, the best of the urban adventure racing teams on that day, Golight Timberland Sprint, rolled and ran across the finish line with a time of 5 hours, 45 minutes, 30 seconds, beating Newcastle Limited Crested Butte by just over 4 minutes. Those two teams and the next four finishers had one thing in common. They were co-ed. At the awards ceremony following the race, I learned that I shouldn't have been surprised by that result.
Well, one of the things that makes adventure racing unique to other sports is that
was traditionally co-ed. And you had co-ed teams of either three, four, or five. And interestingly enough, the co-eds generally win our races overall. So that just goes to show you that the two sexes working together are stronger than the single sex working alone.
Fair enough, and indisputable, at least according to the Wild Scallion results. But guess which team crossed the finish line in 6 hours, 31 minutes, and 21 seconds to learn that it had won first place in the all-male division.
Did you hear that?
You won your division?
We came first in all-male.
I had no idea.
Yes!
That's awesome.
Sweet!
Yep, that's right. It was Cal Lejeune and the rest of Team Smelt.
We're urban adventure champs. You can't beat that.
What's that? What'd you say?
Can't beat that. We're urban adventure champs.
No kidding. That's unbelievable.
This is insane. This is absolutely insane.
When the euphoria had worn off a little, I asked Cal what he'd remember most fondly from his experience in the Wild Scallion.
The best thing we heard, we were right in front of Wrigley Field. We're just passing by, and some guy was crossing the street with his family. He says, "Is this a joke?" I said, no, it's a race.
Paul, Rachel, and Dennis, the members of Team Unmentionable that couldn't figure out which way was north, finished 29th overall in 7 hours, 42 minutes, and 52 seconds. But the day's most important statistic was that among all the wet, tired athletes at the party where the race finished in Lincoln Park, I couldn't find a single competitor who didn't want to run the Scallion again.
Great job, guys.
A toddle in town. Chicago, Chicago, I'm gonna lead you around. You can bet your bottom dollar you'll lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago, the town that Billy Sunday couldn't snap down. On State Street, that great street, I'd just like to say, they do things you don't see on Broadway. You'll have the time of your life. Dug a cat who swung with his wife in Chicago. What a town.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Greg Fazio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view a Wild Scallion gallery by world-renowned photojournalist Guillermo Pequeño Campo, browse Only a Game show archive or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Paul Ecke III, owner and CEO of the Paul Ecke Ranch, one of the nation's leading growers of poinsettias, or poinsettias. I asked him regarding the plant's pronunciation, is it poinsettia or poinsettia?
I don't really care what you call it, just as long as you buy one.
No way. I'm not buying one of those. I hear they're poisonous. My Komodo dragon might eat it. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Down in Illinois.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.